Welcome to the Sentience Institute podcast, where we interview advocates, entrepreneurs, and researchers to better understand the expansion of humanity's moral circle, with a focus on expanding the circle to farmed animals. I'm Jamie Harris, researcher at Sentience Institute. Welcome to our second episode of the podcast. On the first episode, with Kevin Schneider of the Non-Human Rights Project, I briefly outlined some of the strategies we're using to make this the most useful podcast it can be. I won't reiterate those here, but do check out that episode if you're interested. I was excited to have Pei Su from ACT Asia for this episode of the podcast, because ACT Asia seeks to alter attitudes to animals in China through a variety of methods, including through education in schools. This is an interesting contrast to the public outreach methods of many Western animal advocacy organisations, who often focus either on online campaigns or street outreach. As well as running educational campaigns for school children, consumers, and professionals ranging from vets to government officials, ACT Asia also engages in corporate outreach to retailers to secure fur-free commitments. We were able to discuss issues of prioritisation between these different interventions and other possible interventions for animal advocates in China. Finally, UN statistics show that China contains a huge proportion of the world's farmed animal population, including nearly half of the world's farmed pigs and over half of the world's farmed fish. So I was keen to speak to an advocate with in-depth knowledge and experience of the situation there. On our website, we have a transcript of the episode, as well as timestamps for particular topics. We also have suggested questions and resources that can be used to run an event around this podcast in your local animal advocacy or effective altruism group. Please feel free to get in touch with us if you have questions about this, and we would be happy to help. Our guest today is Pei Su, Executive Director for ACT Asia. After earning her master's in sociology, Pei Su interned for several US animal advocacy groups and worked at World Animal Protection. Alongside an Asian veterinarian, Pei co-founded ACT Asia in 2006. Welcome to the podcast, Pei.
Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to be able to talk on your show.
You're very welcome. So at the World Conference on Farm Animal Welfare in 2017, the Chinese Ministry of Agriculture publicly acknowledged the concept of farmed animal welfare. According to a blog post about this by Compassion in World Farming, the Chinese Vice Minister of the Ministry of Agriculture said that promoting animal welfare has become not only an important choice for the green development of agriculture and a significant measure to ensure food safety and healthy consumption, but even more so an important embodiment of human caring in modern society. The Chinese traditional culture has always advocated the concept of raising and using animals with an attitude of love and appreciation. So my question is, what is ACT Asia doing to encourage these values of caring for animals, especially farmed animals?
I set up ACT Asia back in 2006 together with an Asian veterinarian. And at the time, we see the tremendous animal suffering and the treatment these animals have received in our society, including the country like China. And at the time, we feel this is important. We set up an organization and to help the local animal groups or the grassroots groups, they can grow and to learn how to tackle the issue in their own way and through their own culture. And so the issue of animals' sufferings are not mainly rely on international support. And so we organize various training section and workshop for the local groups. For the first 6 years of ACT Asia, we focus, help them to learn what is animal welfare rights issues, what is project management, how to conduct effective campaign. And through this work, we were able to establish a network or animal protection organization throughout China. We also decided to promote our resources within China because ACT Asia's resources are limited. So we have been working in China for the last 13 years, since 2006. The purpose really at ACT Asia is trying to make sure people in the society to understand human-animal nature are all interrelated. And after we've done the capacity building program, we feel it is really important we focus on education because, you know, we need to tackle the long-term change. So we reposition more on our position, more focus on education program on children, consumers, and professional, and use this program to promote compassion and empathy and to allow the people in Asian society or in China to understand the interdependency of all living beings and in our, you know, world. And so we hope the next generation, they can grow up to make the informed choice, and this choice will involve less of animal suffering, less consumes of the meat, or less consume all material which are, you know, added tremendous burden in our planet. And we have seen the challenge we are facing today, particularly through like issue as climate change.
Okay, brilliant. Well, we can kind of dip into some of the specific programs that ACTASIA runs and run through those in a bit more detail in a second. Just a kind of related, though slightly separate issue, is the concern that the growing numbers of animals that are being raised for food in China. So statistics from the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization show that per capita meat consumption has grown threefold since 1990 in China. Thankfully, the government is interested in addressing this issue too. The Chinese Nutrition Society, which I think is associated with the government, has recommended a maximum meat intake of 75 grams per day, which is about half of the current average meat consumption in China. They also encourage any consumption of fish, poultry, eggs or meat to be in moderation. So which of ACTASIA's various programs and interventions are you most excited about as a method of supporting this goal by the government of actually greatly reducing animal product consumption?
We welcome the Chinese government's policy and the various other, you know, non-profit organizations they support. And I think this is all a very positive development on the ground. However, the policy like this is in some way is far away from reality in the society where the food eating is part of the culture so close to people's life, and the eating culture is almost as a leisure rather than to eat to survive. So to reduce meat consumption is probably one of the hardest issues when we are trying to tackle, you know, animal welfare or animal rights issues. And we should not, you know, simplify it. And in ACTASIA, we don't have a program particularly focused on veganism or plant-based food. However, I strongly believe what we are doing is providing that foundation and sowing the seeds to enable our, you know, plant-based movement to go further and faster. The challenge we are facing today is most of Chinese majorities, they don't understand the animal welfare issue or rights issue. We're still in an infancy stage if we, you know, using the comparison between West and East, or compared to, you know, the English-speaking country to China. And we are still struggling on the ground to enable people to understand what does animals mean. Animals are not there just for the human use, and they are not objects. ACTASIA's program focus on children particularly is try to teach these children that animals are sentient. And a lot of people were very surprised we are just focused on such a simple issue. But I believe this is the foundation for, you know, the future generation even start to think about if this is right, the way we treat animal. What's wrong with intensive farming? What's wrong with factory farming? What's wrong with the way these animals being treated? Unless they really understand this, we feel, you know, or in my 25 years of experience, I feel we are just firefighting all the time. We expose the issue, but people are say, oh, okay, this is cruelty. But when they go back to their daily choice, that piece of meat might be still very, you know, delicious to them. They got to, you know, have the true understanding of these animals can feel the pain. These animals, you know, are suffering day and night. The confinement they have received is totally inhumane. Most of the people, they, you know, don't understand this. And I personally, you know, feel we need to building that foundation through our education program. And then, you know, when the kids, they learn they grow them more. And when the right time the campaign has, you know, been launched, we will gain the support more widely. So education is for the long-term change, and that's what we want. We want to, you know, bring in the society, the kids, they will gradually understand and then about this area of the subjects.
So on the ACTASIA's website, mentions that the Caring for Life education program supports the mandatory Chinese curriculum for moral and quality education. There are some impressive stats on the website. So by early 2018, Caring for Life education has been taught to 65,000 children by almost 1,700 trained teachers through 130 schools and more than 20 community centres and holiday camps. So I'm assuming from that description that ACTASIA's model is to provide resources and support to teachers to encourage them to teach these lessons, and that ACTASIA's staff don't actually ever teach the lessons directly themselves?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, it's really interesting because different organizations have had a different approach to this. I'm sure it has worked in the past in other countries, but for instance, there's a group called Students for High Impact Charity that obviously had a slightly different focus, but they tried out several different approaches. So they tried working with teachers, but more seriously experimented with working with volunteer students to set up clubs and run sessions or to run workshops directly themselves. So this group doesn't exist anymore, but there's a post written about their work and the problems they faced on the EA forum, which I'll link to on the notes for this show. So did you try different approaches? Or that, I mean, obviously that kind of seems ideal because it's the minimum time input from your perspective. Was it easy to set up, or how did that work in the first place?
When we want to start the Caring for Life education in school, we started by, you know, taking this based on what I have observed in last, you know, 20 years of movement regarding about human education. It took us 2 years to review all the different literacies with regard to human education, particularly in curriculum, lesson plan, and school activities. We look at these contents, we review the pitfalls, what will happen, and we design a program we want to overcome the pitfalls. People ask me, is this the most effective way, or is hard to get into school? Of course, it's very hard because you are, you know, as an NGO, you come to the, you know, school, tell them to use your material, tell them to use their curriculum time when the academic pressure is so big. So we make sure we done our study, we make sure we prepare all our material very professionally. You know, we fit in with, for example, when we say professionally, is we prepare the curriculum, we prepare the curriculum guideline, we develop the guidance on how to use our material. We also have the code and conducts about, you know, how the educator, when they're teaching, you know, the curriculum, how should they behave? How should they, you know, teach the lessons? And we are very pleased today we have reached this outcome. This is not just because we're lucky. You know, I'm grateful we've been doing well, but we also, because we have invested time to do it properly and to teach in a school, we don't go into the school because of one sympathetic teacher. We make sure we visit the school, we present our project proposal, and with, you know, the film with the curriculum to enable us to have a proper opportunity to speak to the school management authority. And we also need to be smart because ACTASIA has very, you know, small number of the staff. We started this program on school education with two people, and today we have six full-time people, and we teach, you know, we want to the school to teach this curriculum, but we did not feel teaching responsibility is ACTASIA's job. We make sure we train the teachers, or we train the particularly type of the people to be our Caring for Life educator. For example, they could be parents, or they can be university students. They are, you know, study, you know, educations. So the main key is to make sure the teaching responsibility is not within ACTASIA. And this will enable us to reach more adults to understand what we are trying to reach, you know, what we try to teach, you know, is compassion, empathy, is about respect, you know, human kind to animals and protect the nature, and then teach all these issues are interconnected. And so when we go to MOU, we sign an MOU with a school. We don't go in because it's one teacher agree. We make sure this is properly agreed. The school will then, you know, using our lesson plan for 10 sections a year, and that means 10 lessons in one academic year. We also ask them not to change the order of our, you know, curriculum or lesson plan, but they can do more if they feel 10 lessons is not enough. We also provide a training to teach, to train the educator, including primary school teachers or, you know, the parents. They become our Caring for Life educator. So ACT Asia is not teaching ourselves within our personnel, but to enable us to enter one school to teach one single child, we need to go through various process steps, and the school authority have to buy in, the academic director have to buy in, the principal have to agree, and then the teachers have to agree, want to teach. Then when the kids receive the lesson, the parents have to be, you know, happy. Otherwise, they could come in to, you know, make a complaint. So a child's education is never just a child. It's actually the various, you know, decision makers have to agree or influence among that child have to be agree as well. And then we felt this is very, very, you know, successfully to using the program to influence, you know, the institution and to change within the institution. And that's where I think we have using slightly different strategy and approach, as we using different approach to, you know, tackle the tremendous issue we are facing. I'm not saying direct campaign is not important. I'm saying in addition to this, we got to start addressing the fundamental issue. We got to start to sow in the seed, cultivating the ground. So when the campaign is, you know, we want to launch bigger campaign, we have someone on the ground. These kids will grow up to grow, want to support the campaign. We also don't do cold calls, because it's within the cultural context, within the countries, the current situation. We do not think this is the right way for us to do. The way we're doing is tough, but if we are prepared, we believe you can success. And of course, you need to be mindful and you need to be smart as well.
Okay, let's talk briefly about legislative work. So ACT Asia's website doesn't mention it much, but the Changing China report released by ACT Asia in 2011 comes across as more optimistic about legislative work than I would have expected. The report notes that ACT Asia's ongoing capacity building program, introduced in 2006, emphasizes the importance of legislation for the animal protection movement, the important role of animal groups in promoting the creation and implementation of animal protection legislation, and how animal groups can improve and promote animal protection legislation even with limited resources. So by comparison, animal charity evaluators reviewed farmed animal advocacy organizations listed on the GuideStar website in the US and found that about 7% of total resources of these groups were allocated towards influencing policy and the law. So how do you think the kind of proportion of resources spent by animal advocacy organizations in China compares to that figure of 7%?
I think, first of all, we got to recognize that's very incomparable, the two systems. In America, your legislative system, particularly, you got a lobby mechanism. You have a professional lobbyist, you know, you have lobbyists, you know, lobby company. They are doing, you know, the job to either lobby the legislator on different sides, you know, different stakeholders. They can have their different inputs. That's not how it works in the part like in China. They certainly know such a mechanism existing at the moment. We have maybe more indirect or soft lobby in some sort of extent, but it definitely is not a structure as mature as the West. Also, I think when we wrote the Changing China report, it was at a stage there was a very high hope there is a legislation regarding the protection of animals. It's either called cruelty,
you know, prevention of cruelty law or animal welfare law and or animal care law. This type of legislation, that's at the time we hope it would be, you know, in some way could be drafted, openly discussed. But we found a lot of people from, particularly from outside of China, they don't particularly understand how the legal system works and how a piece of legislation, when they need to be passed by national level or provincial level or municipality level, how does it work? That really was what were the purpose. Of course, in the report, it did say, you know, between 2006 and 2008, we did make a specific effort to make sure the animal groups, you know, was one of very particular, you know, force to ensure legislation could be passed or could be in favor of the animals species to be, you know, more active, taking more active role. But the challenges still remain. It's really, like you said, probably in a similar thing, it's not enough effort to be spent it on. It's when there are so many different challenges. So tend to be suffer in the animal movement is two issues, you know, two areas work. One is lobby, looking at policy legislation. The other side is, you know, education. That's the two areas tend to be more overlooked. And because there are so many immediate suffering, you know, is happening. There's so many requiring direct action, immediate attention. And I think that's where we need to reflect on this, how we, you know, spend more time and energy and also resources on this side. And first of all, you've got to bring the right groups. You know, lots of groups, they might work on animal issues, but they don't have expertise. So themselves actually was, you know, a block. It could be the block themselves to prevent the legislation pass because they didn't understand how the law, a piece of law, is drafted in a sense.
Okay, so this links into, there's kind of two different trade-offs here. One is the kind of institutional versus individual interventions. And as you kind of mentioned earlier, some of the interventions that Act Asia carries out are kind of, although they appear to be individually focused, there's that kind of institutional focus as well, because you're trying to build up education within the Chinese, sort of within the Chinese education system, have that focus on animals and building compassion and that sort of thing. So I'm thinking, so Sentience Institute has kind of summarized some of the evidence for and against this institutional versus individual trade-off on our website in what we call the Foundational Question Summaries section. I'm wondering what you think about how Chinese advocates, kind of what proportion of resources should be spent on interventions targeted at individuals and what proportion should be spent on interventions targeted at institutions in China?
I believe the individual effort and institutional change are interrelated. As an organization, you have limited resources. You may not be able to do the both sides. So some organizations, they will focus more on change with institution. Some of them would rather to be the outsider, making that big noise, making individual change to push to have the, you know, the institution to change. The fourth, you know, if you look at, I think you look at the, either is, if the issue is in the middle, you're looking right side or left side. I look at it as a circle. You know, I think one will lead to each other. At this stage of China, I don't feel only purely focus on individual outreach, it will, you know, reach the goal as effective as we want to reach at the sense we would like to see. I feel this should be, you know, both happening, but one might be emphasized more than the others. So I know teaching in the school seems to be we are teachers just target individual children, but as I explained, you know, school are educating our future, you know, generation, the future leaders, the future, you know, citizens. But to be able to have that link and to enter the school, you got to see the institution will allow you to go in. And I think that's why we developed curriculum. We did not, you know, making our caring for life education course for children become ad hoc public talk. And that's where I feel that is what we got to change, is influence the not saying that 50 students is not important, but I feel if we're really smart, we can make that, you know, 50 students, they can be happen at the same place, have more people to join in if we get institution on board. Same as the fashion designer, you know, when we talk about the compassion in fashion, we can say, we make the fashion designers, you know, get on board. But at the end of the day, they want to be able to sell. They want to be able, their brand, you know, they are different, standing out as an ethical brand, more recognized by other brands. They are not joined the free retailer scheme. Who will make that, you know, different is the consumer. So I think we're trying to do both sides. However, we will have emphasis, probably percentage more on change with institution in the sense, and when we can, we will reach the public in the way, you know, not as big as the other, if you talk about really look at the figures and percentage in a sense. But I do feel purely just using the public to driving forward to change legislation, I think is harder. But it doesn't mean they, you know, they are the area to be given up. But I do think there is a choice you have to make when you only have $1, you know, or you have $100, what is a percentage? At the moment, we probably will do, you know, more than, you know, spend more on the institutional change rather than just an individual. But it does, it will have to helping each other in a sense. Does that make sense, what I'm saying now?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, really interesting. And I don't think anyone, no one would deny that they're interconnected. I was just interested where you kind of would place the difference between the two and where you think you'd place the emphasis, and you've answered that. So let's move on. I want to briefly touch on a slightly different topic. A report by the careers advice organization, 80,000 Hours, notes that after the US and the UK, China is probably the next most important country in developing and shaping transformative artificial intelligence. AI development in China has strong support from the state, an abundance of data from a large pool of mobile phone users, and potentially of talent transfer from overseas. Thinking about the long-term future, the extent to which the companies and researchers working on AI development place value on the lives and experiences of non-human sentient beings, including animals, could be vitally important. ActAsia runs trainings for a variety of professionals, and obviously we've spoken quite a bit about in enhancing compassion and that kind of educational aspect. Do you think there could ever be scope for ActAsia to work directly with AI companies and researchers?
Yes, I do believe it's very important for the charity sector, non-profit sector, to start to think how we link with UI, use it as an advantage. You know, AI has been, like you said, it's been particularly, you know, popular and, you know, developed in China or in Asia because of the technology advancement they have. We, as a sector, or even ActAsia, this is very new to us. But actually, even in the last week, we invited a specialist. He is just talking about online digital learning, you know, the possibility to link the learning with the AI intelligence. How do you build that? You know, this is a very forward thinking, you know, to grab that, you know, advance. But we also will try to, you know, put in is because of AI development. So it's one way to use the technology. You jump in this big wagon, you know, to grab the opportunity to advance what we're doing. That's one angle. The other angle, ActAsia also is trying to say, you know, AI is developing, but it's also show more importance of emotional intelligence. You know, in the World Social Economic Forum, they already talk about in next 10 years, empathy actually is one of very key, you know, factors or key elements when it's in your job skills. So the empathy as from a person, it has to be, you know, there, because otherwise what's the difference between us and a machine? We will never compete with a machine. But is that humans, you know, compared to empathy, make that, you know, difference between us and a machine? So I think there's a dual purpose when we look at the AI. And certainly how we, you know, we certainly from now we're looking in 2020, for example, when when we are going to launch the curriculum for, you know, with London College Fashion, about when the designer, they learn, you know, the sustainable fashion, they start to think they're going to stop to using fur free. So we are going to promote this curriculum. We are really starting to now, how do we use this as a through digital learning platform, through the AI, we make it more innovative and make it them feel more effectively to receive the program and to use a curriculum.
So do you think there's opportunities to actually work directly with those researchers and support them to build those kind of models and understanding of compassion into their own work?
Certainly. I think there's a two, like I said, it's a two side. One side is we have to look at how AI can advance our current program. The other side is working with AI specialists, researchers, to talk about why compassion and empathy is important during the process, why is emotional intelligence important in that sense. Otherwise, you could have advanced, you know, the technology advanced, but they might not have a moral or ethical standards. That's what we have seen in Asia country already. There's so many controversial developments. You know, in that sense, we've got to work with these people. So, for example, in America, there was the company they are talking about using AI to develop the medical research or the medical, you know, treatments. And we will be, you know, in we have opportunity, we will be talking to them to insert this is what is a humanity, you know, what is a compassion empathy within AI development. We've got to start that dialogue. That's why last week when we hosted a forum, in a small seminar in University of Oxford, Oxford Center, and we are talking about how science and humanity have to be integrated, and that science is including AI as well.
I'd like to discuss some of the kind of potential bottlenecks that are preventing ACT Asia and other groups operating in China from achieving even more for animals than they currently do, and some potential solutions to those bottlenecks. So at various points, the 2016 charity law in China expresses concern to ensure that charities' activities do not endanger national security or social public interests and are not contrary to social morals. So this comes from the unofficial English translation of the law, and I'm not 100% certain how well those concepts translate from the original Chinese. But what can organisations that seek to enhance compassion for animals in China do to ensure that they very clearly and firmly support social public interests and morals rather than challenge them in any way?
I think you have to, wherever you work, you know, you have to work within the local political and social context. And this is applied in various ways, in particularly the legal framework. You know, you need to make sure you are following the legislation you can, and you need to, we need to make sure what you are doing, you know, it can be magnified. You know, you can make people want to follow it and comfortably and without any concerns. So I don't particularly feel some sort of expose type of campaign works in China under the social context. You know, I'm not saying that's wrong, but I didn't feel personally, I don't feel this is the stage we can, you know, risk about the effort we're trying to build. And that doesn't mean you are not saying there are challenges. We're facing enormous challenges in every single different way. Sometimes people cannot even understand how difficult it is in a very little things, you know, and you sometimes cannot express, you just have to live with it in a way, say that's what you choose to work in that country. You know, some people say, you seem to think, you know, I was in Oxford last week. I was talking to a group of academics. They talk about science and humanity. They talk about the future, what we're going to do with the world of the challenge we are facing. And then, you know, I feel we cannot single out issue. We have to start to see the interconnectedness of the problem we are facing today is never one issue on its own, never one cause. They're interrelated. Then they will say, okay, you seem to say only good thing about China. And I say, yes, of course, because as a, you know, advocates, we need to remember to celebrate our small achievements, because otherwise no one will last. It's too unbearable. That's one thing. The second thing, I think there are enormous challenges in terms of several freedom issues, in terms of, you know, the limitation we can do, even the basic understanding why nonprofit want to operate in that part of the world. You see, you have in England particularly, you can back to, you know, 1824, you know, you have a prevention of recruiting, you have the groups, they started advocate about this. Now we're in 2019. We still are just a very infancy stage, even just for the non-profit or charitable, you know, program to start. So the understanding is huge. However, okay, a lot of bad things happen, a lot of challenges happen. What are we going to do? We can say, okay, we walk away. We're not going to do it because it's too bad. We don't want to just talk about a new thing because we don't want to just talk about good. You can say, I want to talk about all the bad, but it still doesn't help in reality. You know, there are challenges. We have to overcome the challenges. We have to be able to work within the framework that allows us to work, because if we don't, nothing is going to change. Do you see what I'm saying? It's, you know, you can't look at China and say, this is a problem, this is a problem, this is a problem. Why are you not talking about the problem? I'm saying is, lots of people talk about the problems, and I'm not saying these problems don't exist. You know, they exist in every single way, but there are positive things happen. They are a group of people. They're doing, you know, the job. They want to make that changes. And I think that is where we are, because otherwise, if we walk away, then, you know, good thing would not carry on. But that will affect the people who are, you know, saying, you know, why you're not pushing a boundary. You know, we will certainly push in a boundary when we can, but you've got to balance. It doesn't mean you lost your integrity. It doesn't mean you are not recognize the issue. But I just think there is a balance. You've got to, you know, look at it. What would be the best way for us to move forward as well?
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. So let's talk about empowering those advocates and those people trying to make those changes. So Animal Charity Evaluator's report on China is most optimistic that foreign groups collaborate with locally registered groups rather than seek to establish an independent presence in China. But this approach relies on there being well-run local groups in China that can be collaborated with, and there being advocates who are willing to take on that work themselves. So in your experience, are there many such individuals who are keen to work to improve consideration of animals' interests in China?
First of all, I would like to point it out, a lot of the research, you know, a lot of the data you're quoting is actually by a non-Chinese group. You know, there's lots of this, what you're quoting, they say this, they say that. That is still from a Western perspective. You know, I have talked to a lot of groups in America. When I explain further, they actually say, well, we actually don't know China that much in itself. And I think I have to keep emphasize the animal ones in infancy stage, same as the charity movement, same as the charitable, you know, activities, is still relatively new within the country. We're facing lots of challenges. It's not only about that the people know what is the issue is, but we are facing the challenge is even just by recruiting people we want to work with us. They want to work for, you know, these, you know, the charitable cause. And that is making a huge, you know, difference. By comparison, you know, we have to educate everything from scratch. In the West, you would have a people want to queue up, you know, to work within the charity sector. They will want to say, you know, I'm really passionate. And the charity actually say, we haven't got a position in that part of the world. I think every organization still struggle to loss of talents, you know, because of various reasons. And I do feel we got to, you know, it would be good for the international organization. They can land it on the ground, find the organization they can work with, perfect partner, bam, you know, you can go very further. When I started ACT Asia, I feel there was a misunderstanding, the gap between what you think the animal groups or local groups they need and what they think they need. It could be a huge gap difference. You know, they might think they lack of funding. You might think they lack of knowledge. And how do you match these two together? Without, you know, the cultivated, the animal group to support them, we might not be able to get what we think is a perfect, you know, partnership or perfect working relationship.
So I'm trying to establish, I guess, how easy it is to find quality candidates for roles at ActAsia or other places. It's, from what you were just saying there, I'm wondering whether actually it's not a problem to find quality candidates for those roles. And it's about the kind of finances and ability to actually support a large enough organization to find roles for those talented individuals.
No, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm actually saying is it's really extremely difficult to find the right candidates, organizations, because not because of materialistic or resource-wise lack of. I think what it lack of is the professionalism, lack of the professional development within the charity sector or non-profit sector, the understanding of the commitment of professionalism when they conducted an animal, you know, conducted a non-profit organization. That is already the first tier of challenge. Then your second tier of challenge is to find the people work for the charity sector. They want to work on animal issue. They have a really truly understanding of animal issue, not only on companion animals, but non-companion animals issue, including fur, including factory farming, including laboratory animals. If you look at animal groups, we know it's very, very handful of them only work on, you know, these non, you know, companion animal issues. So the challenge actually is difficult. And we've got to be, you know, look at the commercial sectors. When a lot of business people, they invest their business in China, some of them have really miserable failing experience. It's not everyone is doing business. China is all singing and dining, all, you know, getting huge profits. Some of the really painful experience, they didn't come out to the public. So when we go to, you know, international organization, when you go to the country, you got to look at, is this the right time for you to set up the office there? Is it right time the people you are hiring really understand your organizational needs? Do they really understand what you ask them to do? Is that possible? Without all this, we are talking in the issue without the true understanding of each other. And if we don't have a true understanding of each other, the work to be conducted will not be effective.
So do you have any thoughts about the best ways to increase the pool of talented and capable individuals seeking to work in this area in China?
I think the way, first of all, I think we have to be patient. I think sometime when we set up a program in China, we want an immediate result. You know, we haven't talked much about vet education. When we talk about, we found, you know, veterinary as our best animal ambassador or advocates within China, they don't even, you know, really understand the concept of animal welfare, how to make that into the practice, how that related to, you know, their treatment towards animal. And even changing that perception took us almost 9 years to reach where we are. Now they are the best, you know, advocates for what we want to promote. Sometimes when we go to into the country, we want an immediate result. We want to say, how do you help me to stop, you know, donkey, for example, the donkey skin consumption? How do you help me to get the rhino to be, you know, stopped to be used? There's no quick fix. You know, sometimes you might have to bring your staff to be trained. They truly understand what your organization want to do is achievable. And I think that's what I've urged is the first thing is understand the local context and lower your expectation at the beginning, and then work it out, the strategy that work within that country, and pull in the right, you know, expertise to look at it. You know, someone to be able, you know, speak Chinese and English doesn't mean they understand the issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. So that kind of local understanding, that cultural knowledge, I'm sure is absolutely vital. I'm interested in terms of, say, people that you have worked with or you've hired, or even that other organizations working in China have hired. I'm interested in how much difference there tends to be between the kind of the top candidates who eventually get the roles and between the near best candidates.
Finding the right, you know, local partner or finding the right staff to working on the ground is always challenging. particularly when the China living standard is more and more expensive as well. It's very common when the organization are struggling for funding, you might find a second candidate, you know, because they are not as, you know, such a high cost, and you get things moving. But more and more, if you work longer and longer, for example, what ActAsia stage now, we've been working in China for 13 years, we have, you know, established a reputation, we will require more, you know, work done, and you will require almost the leading figures, you know, the people more experienced, they know what, you know, to hire the experienced people will advance your job more quickly, the best candidate, like what you're saying. But lots of time, that will cost, you know, the budget-wise, it may not be able to afford. You know, time again, we very often lose the best talents because they work three times as harder, but they probably receive half of what the commercial rates. And that's where we become, you know, the circle become vicious circle. And when I started in ActAsia, we was hoping we were able to support these talents. We were help to support more people to work on our side. You know, I always give the example, if you look at the fur industry or factory farming industry, look at how many people they just hire to do their marketing and how many people we have in our sector to hire to do our marketing. You know, it's just not comparable because we're just so little and so short of personnel. I would now would like to put within organization, if I can, we would put more, you know, resources on right talents, people, and they can do the job instead of the second best, you know, staff, I think.
Yeah, sure. So that sounds like the financial considerations are a significant bottleneck at the moment. It's preventing you hiring the staff that you'd like. So I'm interested about the fundraising situation then. I'm not sure whether it applies to all organisations, but I know that some charitable organisations are restricted from fundraising in China. Does the government tend to prefer fundraising from within China or from outside supporters?
I think you need to follow the local country's legislation to enable to raise the fund within China. You need to have, you know, certain criteria to be met. They are more and more corporate or individual. There are potential there to support your cause. However, the philanthropy concept, the support without, you know, directly their commercial gain is still quite hard. It's very common, you know, you get one sponsorship, then they will say, you know, for example, they might say, oh, I'll give you in-kind support, like I'll give you office space. Then they will immediately say how many likes you're going to bring into their, you know, to their account. And sometimes we say, none, you know, we can't do that because we are not your PR and advertising agencies. You know, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. You got this, you spend one, you're going to get one or two. You know, charitable corporate social responsibility is not always is, you know, will bring direct impact or direct, you know, benefit to your charity, to your corporate in a sense. So I think there are potential, there are opportunity there, but the concept to understand that sponsorship, I still think is still quite early in comparison. That's why you probably need both. Our bottleneck, really the biggest strength, you know, is in financial support. We cannot afford direct mailing. We don't have an individual supporter because we never have, you know, enough fundraising cost in a sense. ActAsia is very frugal. We spend, you know, there was last week, there was one our organization CEO asked me, say, why are you not building a reserve? Why you spend all your money on projects? And yes, we got to learn to building that because without doing that, we will be unsustainable ourselves. But it's very common we haven't got that regal space because a lot of founder, you know, gradually there are some founder now they agree to pay the salary, but a lot of founder they still look at the project, they just want to pay the direct cost, but they forgot the most valuable assets is our staff. They are the one doing R&D. They are the one make sure the program can be, you know, delivered on the ground, can be, you know, suitable and would not be scratched. You know, all this is the power of our staff, but we are struggling big, big time to even that make that sustainable. If I go to a founder, say, can you help me to hire staff to do fundraising? We haven't been able to success because I want to be able to create that sustainable income ourselves as well. But at the moment, we're still very hand to mouth. And that is one of our biggest challenge.
Okay, so where does most of the funding come from at the moment? Are you able to fundraise outside of China, or does it have to be focused within China?
No, we do fundraise. You know, we got some anomalous, you know, support. We certainly have the funding support within China because they are, you know, we have to be variable, but we just haven't got like thousands of individual members in the sense we rely more about grant and, you know, small amount of corporate funding, individual major donors, but not the massive, you know, big membership in the sense.
Okay, so do I take from what you're saying that if you were, say, just granted another $100,000 or something, would you prioritize that spending on establishing some of these more sustainable fundraising mechanisms then?
Yes, if I can. But sadly, most of the founder itself is more project oriented. But really to be able sustainable, for example, we are so virtual. We have very, very low, you know, overhead costs. We all scattering in different, even within China, we have, you know, different parts of the city, we have different staff. We don't even have a budget really to bring the staff together to have sustainable development, you know, to training, you know, to give them the break, to really, you know, give them the time to breathe, to reflect what we're doing, you know, because we just haven't got that funding for the development. We don't have a funding to hire a professional fundraiser. If you look at all the big organizations, they have professional fundraiser, they have a communication director. We haven't got that. We wish we would have someone, you know, we did a couple of years ago, we did ask, you know, try to seek funding for support us to build our digital marketing strategy and enable us to hire the communication and marketing director, but we were not success so far.
Okay, so we've got, these are kind of two interrelated but slightly separate difficulties, is having the local talent available and then also that being partially caused by a lack of funding and the fundraising problems. So for a talented young person in a, say, in a wealthy Western country who is equally excited and likely to be successful at doing, say, an intensive course in Chinese and then going to work for ActAsia in China, or in seeking to maximize their income and then donate as much of it as they could to ActAsia in the country that they currently live in, which would you recommend or prefer?
The second, to, you know, talented, you know, and their salary and their support. I want to give you an example. I hope it's not dilute too much, but for example, there's a handful of corporate that will come to, you know, us. They even was one of the top, you know, consulting company in the world, and the Shanghai branch will say, we want to help you. You know, can we do something together? But lots of this time, the program it ended up is we become a voluntary service organizations. You know, we have to design a program specifically just for this organization to enable them to practice their voluntarism. But that doesn't always work for our projects. For example, in our Caring for Life School project, you know, for children, we have to, if you want to be a volunteer, you need to dedicate it for 10 sessions academic year. That means your company have to support you. You can't say, I'm going to a business trip, I'm not teaching, because we just cannot let the school dance like that, you know. But a lot of time, people will say, let's work with you or volunteer for you, but it's always on their terms. We can't. And also, I think it's not like China doesn't have talents. We are gradually finding some talents, but we need to be very gentle with them. We need to make sure they don't see working these as, you know, something will, you know, affect, you know, their lifestyle or will affect their way of life, and they are not feel insecure in various considerations. So I don't particularly feel to learn Chinese, go to work there is some sort of method to be promoted. You know, I'm not saying you can't, but some individual might be very passionate, want to do that, but it doesn't always fit in the sense, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, that's really interesting. So this is a slight contrast from, so this idea kind of comes from, there's a report by the organization 80,000 Hours, which is specifically about kind of China experts and kind of people being able to kind of mediate between interests in China and supporters in other parts of the world. But that's, yeah, that's really interesting to hear that you have this different view.
But I think the 18,000 hours, I think you need to look at the voluntary work, what type of voluntary work, you know, but the social political context, that I can't explain more further about the change of society is very different now. You know, it could benefit, but when you're really looking for professional work and some of the issue is not so well known or so familiar with the public, if you say, I'm going to teach in an orphanage, you might think, okay, that is something possible, it could be quite straightforward, but it's, you know, we are talking about issues, it's not even a majority the issues for the society. So many people tend to think, what animal issue? Why are you doing that? You know, in a sense, I think it's very difficult to compare about that.
So you went to university in the UK, didn't you? And you worked for Wild Animal Protection for several years. I think there's a post on the Unbound Project's website that says you interned with several animal rights organisations in the US. Do you think that Chinese advocates would benefit more from seeking experiences inside or outside of China in terms of animal protection organisations? For example, should they seek to work with existing Chinese groups seeking to build compassion for animals in China? Or assuming that they're willing to travel, is it better to get experience working with large organizations based in countries with more established animal protection movements?
I was lucky. I started from a grassroots. So I understand the grassroots, they're struggling, what the day-to-day challenging they are facing. Then I was burned out. As a young woman, I can't understand why we are such a minority and why, you know, they don't, the legislator or media, they don't listen to people like me. So I left, you know, the country. I spent a year to stay in different animal organizations, you know, and from right to welfare to human education in America and Europe, because at the time I want to see how could they be so sustainable in a sense? How can they become so professional? Why is the animal group can establish as a group to get funding and get media attention, etc.? And that was what my purpose. And then that's why I went to study in the UK. In the UK, my thesis at the time was, who participate in the animal rights movement? Who are these people? What are the difference between, you know, where I was until now? And I think all of this is enable you to see, you know, the grassroots and bigger picture. And when I work for World Society for the Protection of Animals, now called WAP, I was in the heart of international movement. You know, we have branch offices, we have lots of international projects. I was leading for the late Asia, you know, the director of the projects in Asia, and then lead to, I was working with all the member of organization around the world. So from grassroots to the international, to the bigger scale of the global, you know, mobilization movement of organizations, I experienced both. And I think that's at my best advantage. And I think if someone asks me, would they do it? I will ask them to do both. I do think you've got to understand the local struggling, local context. Then when you look at the global lens, you know how to transform back to where your country is. I think we used to have, say, global vision, local action. And it seems really simple, but actually it's very complex and it's very difficult. If you look at all the international development, all the international projects, you know, what does that actually mean? You know, who is doing the project in this sense and who is driving that seat? What we are doing in China, we will never say this is what we decide with the Western experts, you should do it. We always is, this is a blueprint, this is a map we can do. But when we look into implementing it in China, we might say, okay, we have to, you know, bend these, we have to, change these and to make it work. That, again, require a lot of time and effort and also experience. And I think that's why what you were saying is, if they can, I think they should do something on the ground and then move to see international. It may not be like me to take a year, maybe the internship for work experience for a certain amount of time, you know, the animal groups can, you know, afford. Sometimes the group in a way may not want to have that kind of hustle because they are come and go. But if there is a opportunity like that, I certainly think that is will be very useful.
Okay, interesting. So another kind of opportunity that people might have is to think about time in for-profit roles or non-profit roles and the different experiences they get there. So I'm thinking as well, if there are any aspiring CEOs or executive directors listening to this podcast, would you guess that in general it's more important for them to develop experience in animal advocacy organizations or experience in management in other opportunities? So for example, if somebody's working in the for-profit sector, or they could be working in, say, a public sector role, and they see prospects for promotion and management experience, do you think it's more important for them to continue with that experience, or is that plausibly more useful than seeking direct work in animal advocacy organizations earlier on?
I think as a CEO or as a leader organization, you do have to look at management. You do look at your finance, you need to have to look at your development, HR, admin, you know, projects, everything. So you are not just focused on the projects. That is a strength if we can get from the corporate sector, you know, they move to the nonprofit sector. However, the nonprofit sector, if you have the CEO, they are in the management background, they don't know the issue itself, they don't know the charity sector itself, then they rely on their key members. So for example, you must have a very strong project directors, they understand what they're doing on the ground. Otherwise you're going to be blind leading blind. And so I think it's not impossible, you know, to work it out, but that have to balance. If you have animal background, like myself, or project background, when you move to a management role, you got to really look at it, say, oh my God, we have to have look at all our costs. We have to look at more budget more closely instead of organic develop just hand to mouth. You know, we just do whatever we think is the opportunity. We have to learn to become more professional to into that management, you know, managing your organization professionally. So that is the balance you have to do. However, if your organization's chief is only in management background without understanding animal issues, without understanding international development project issue, then the other, your right arm or left arm, whatever, you've got to have someone to fulfill that gap. Otherwise, it's a disaster. You know, I have seen various organizations have happened like that. And I think that was one of the reasons I decided to set up ActAsia. I clearly see there was a gap between what the international community think, what the countries need, and what actually the countries need itself. And how do you work out the balance to work as a together and find the best solution forward?
ActAsia has mostly worked in China so far, I believe. Have there been any efforts to expand the program to other Asian countries, or is the focus very much still in China? So in a 2018 webinar that you gave called Concepts and Lessons on Humane Education, you mentioned that you'd been looking into opportunities in Pakistan. Did much come of those efforts?
Yes. We do feel China is such a powerful nation. They have, you know, commercially, they have impacts politically on different parts of Asia as well. We have been working in China for extensively in the last 13 years. We feel some of our China experience, China model, it could be, you know, duplicated or can be applied to other parts of Asia country. And in my experience, I found some of the experience we have in China probably is more applicable than the European or North American experience for other Asia country. So China in last year, they have the policies is to influence or, you know, close working with all the west part of China, west southwest part of China, that's including Nepal, you know, Pakistan, you know, India, all and all the Middle Asia, you know, post Russian states. So that's how we start thinking strategically we could using that. And we had contacts from Pakistan. You know, we were introduced to the Pakistan Singh province. So it's a provincial label equivalent to the American states label. We were talking to the education department directly. Through our 18 months of effort, we are now, we had the various meetings. We're going to start our master training program in October. That we will start 50 schools as a pilot for first year of primary school education students. So we will train the master trainer, and the master trainer will train the school principals or teachers. So it's in that sort of pyramid system to reach the bigger mass in the sense. And we're very, very excited about, you know, this opportunity. Again, we're working with institutes, we're working inside institute through the education system to make that, to make our Caring for Life education to reach the students.
Mm-hmm. And would the program be the same in Pakistan, or would it be just very similar outlines but with some local tweaking?
It must be, you know, we must be able to adapt it to the local culture, you know, local religion, etc. I think the framework, the guidelines, you know, is there, but related to the actual lesson plan, it might need to be adapted in the sense. We don't know yet how much that content it was regarding about lesson plan will actually need to be changed or adapted, but the whole framework, the standard, you know, the curriculum standard, the curriculum guidelines, that will not be changed. You know, the purpose for objective and purpose for setting up this course within the country won't be changed, but this actual lesson plan might be different. And we actually was encouraging the teachers, they develop their own lesson plan. Our lesson plan is really try to make it as easy as possible for the teachers that came to teach, but they don't have time to develop the new lesson plan. Like what you mentioned, you know, to me earlier, is some of the lesson plan in the West is much more, you know, flexible. We are taking the angle is if they don't know the issues, if they don't understand what we try to achieve, to expect the teachers to develop lesson plan might be quite challenging because they have academic tasks need to be fulfilled. And that's why we develop our own lesson plans.
So how frequently are you able to share experiences and strategic ideas with other groups trying to increase consideration of animals' interests in China and other Asian countries? I know that there's already a couple of conferences in Asia seeking to connect groups working to help animals. There's the World Conference on Farm Animal Welfare, jointly hosted by the UN Food and Agriculture Organization and the International Cooperation Committee of Animal Welfare. There's also the Asia for Animals Symposium, which will be held in Dalian in China this year on the 18th to 20th October. And additionally, the Animal Advocacy Conference Asia is scheduled for September or October 2020 with a focus specifically on farmed animals. So have you found much use at those sorts of conferences, and have you had many other opportunities to interact with the animal advocates outside of those conferences?
We welcome advocacy group to contact us to discuss what we, you know, how we can work together. For example, on the fur issue, we have Asia Fur Free, you know, network. You know, we know if we want to do work within Asia context, we can have contacts in different area. To develop cross, you know, continent link or cross country link within the continent, again, it requires effort and planning. At the moment, we haven't had that resources yet. We would love to, you know, to using our Caring for Life education model to host a special conference is in for Asian audience. It's a little bit like in America, they have, you know, human education conferences, so you invite all states or international audience to come. We haven't had that budget. However, we have developed, for example, we Caring for Life guide that is on website. It's a 64 pages of documents. It was really encouraging someone that said, oh, all right, I quite like to start a similar program within, you know, my own, you know, respective country. And we would say, well, maybe this is a basic, you know, first step to look at what in the document, how we started. And we listed the 10 points, you know, for you to what you can do to start this term, you know, this program with following the 10 steps. Is that something you think you can do? If you can, then we can start it from that. And that's how we found our local partner in Pakistan. Was I was speaking in Asia for Animal Conference in 2017 in Nepal. Then they approached us. We started to, you know, guide them what documents for them to read, etc. from there. And then we developed the concrete project. But again, this is taking 2 years to support this initiative as well.
Okay, Pei, I think I could probably go on asking you lots and lots of questions forever, but don't want to take up too much of your time. And so how can listeners find you online and support your work?
Yes, we could have just www.actasia.org to find us, and there's an online donation system. And if you want to get in touch with us, it's info@actasia.org. We need lots of support. We're facing lots of challenges, but we're also very positive. We're going to Pakistan. This is the country where, you know, the human, animals, nature are all sufferings. With moving, you know, into a new country, we need more support as well. We hope everyone can check out our website and get in touch with us.
Excellent. Thank you very much for joining me and for all your really interesting answers, Pei.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. You can subscribe to the Sentience Institute podcast in iTunes, Stitcher, or other podcast apps. You can find out more about our work and check out the links to the resources mentioned in this podcast at sentienceinstitute.org.